From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Republics Ancient and Modern, and Literary Representations of the Self. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. They were also the themes of two recent summer seminars for high school teachers sponsored by the National Humanities Center. First on this edition of Soundings, a discussion about ancient and modern republicanism. My guests are Paul Ray of the University of Tulsa and Patricia Reifsnyder of Germantown Friends School in Philadelphia. Following that, a conversation about modern literary representations of the self. My guests in that portion of the program will be Patricia Meyer Spax of Yale University and Sarah Fulcia of Deering High School in Portland, Maine. From the University of Tulsa, here is Paul Ray, who served as a faculty member for the Center's Summer Institutes on Republics, Ancient and Modern.
I suppose it's important to me as a college professor because it's important to me as a citizen. I think it would be fair to say that republicanism is a rare phenomenon in history. And in a certain sense, I think in our own time, in our own century, it's an endangered species.
We're talking republicanism with a little r.
Absolutely.
We're not talking partisan politics here.
No, not at all.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you could look back 50 years. 50 years ago, at the time of the Munich crisis, Winston Churchill rose in the House of Commons, and he spoke of the liberal democracies, and of Britain's liberal democracy in particular, being weighed in the balance. And he intimated that it might be found wanting. I think the history of the last 50 years would suggest that liberal democracy is still being weighed in the balance. And it's not altogether clear that in 100 years it will still exist. If you go back 200 years, to the struggle for the ratification of the American Constitution, Alexander Hamilton wrote in The First Federalist, "It has been frequently remarked that it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country, by their conduct and example, to decide the important question whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force." In a sense, it seems to me that in the 20th century, it's been reserved to the people of this country to decide whether men can continue to govern themselves on the basis of reflection and choice, or whether, in fact, they will be subject in the future simply to accident and force.
Now, these are important themes. Pat Reifsnyder, tell me why it's important to you as a high school teacher to talk about these themes that Paul Ray has outlined. You begin way, way back. You begin with Plato, Aristotle. Again, that's kind of heady stuff for high school kids, isn't it?
Well, yes, but they're perfectly capable of it. I have to agree with Paul very strongly, though, that it's incredibly important to talk with kids about the continuance of republican forms of government, of the kind of government of choice that we have. Because, for instance, my seniors this last year are old enough to vote. They voted, in many of them, in the primary election this spring. And out of that, they look at November, and we have a choice between malevolence and incompetence in Philadelphia, and a partisan comment. But and they say, "Is this what it's all about, Mrs. Reifsnyder? Is this what the choice is that we have?" And they look at the presidential choices in the future, and they say, "Wait a minute. Is this what the Constitution was framed for?" And they have a lot of questions coming out of Watergate. There's a real drop since then in the student willingness to believe that participation, that I can make a difference, that kind of thing.
Give me some more examples of the kinds of things that you have talked about in this summer institute.
Well, In the Summer Institute, what we've done is we've gone back to the very beginning of Republican experience, mm-hmm. to the ancient Greeks. We've also looked at the medieval republics, particularly the medieval and Renaissance republics of Italy. And then we've worked our way up in a very rapid run over history, but without any hesitation about going as deep as possible into what John Adams would call revolution principles, into mm-hmm. principles of liberty, what underlies it, what motivates it, what makes it work. And the purpose of it is so that those who teach are young in private high schools and in public high schools, and most of our teachers are from public high schools, will begin to have a better sense of what underlies liberty, mm-hmm. what allows people to govern themselves, and not to be told what to do, but in fact to control their rulers.
Mm-hmm. Pat, is this stuff important to you? Do you feel like you're in a civics lesson?
Is this not a patriotic exercise?
It isn't.
We were laughing about this last night, that we felt infinitely more patriotic mm-hmm. at the end of this seminar, which was not something we had at all anticipated. But the thing that is exciting is for us is to consider what makes a community and what makes it work and what keeps men as free as possible within that community, and what are the conflicts that are going to come up and how some of these ideas have changed. I think yesterday.
Give me an example. Can you do that? Can you be specific for me? Name something that.
Yesterday, Paul, in class, we were talking about Aristotle and his views that some men are better than others.
Mm-hmm. That dirty
word,
elitism.
More competent than others, should be leaders, and that when the change comes and what that change means, if you start saying, "Well, men are created equal," and what an incredible idea that is, and what that's going to mean, and how scary it is.
Yes, ancient republicanism is built upon aristocratic principles. Mm-hmm. It's built upon the notion that some men have a natural claim to rule because of their qualities. Modern republicanism, and this is one of the big differences, is based upon the idea of the natural equality of men. They all have bodies. They all have the desire for self-preservation. They all or almost all have families, and they want to take care of their families, and their rights are not derived from their qualities of superiority, mm-hmm. Their transcendence, their almost divine qualities. They're derived from their simple humanity.
Pat, how are you going to teach stuff like that to high school students? Again, help me to understand how kids today will respond to ideas such as
this. Well, if we... In the world history course that we have, which takes 2 years, which is a luxury most teachers do not have, we can start with the ancient republics, and we can talk about the idea of innate differences and the aristocratic principle, and we can trace that through with Magna Carta, moving into Machiavelli and Hobbes, Locke. Mm-hmm. We're pretty excited about Trenchard and Gordon right now, the English Whig writers, the Commonwealth men, and their ideas. And they seem to be quite accessible. Their writing is not difficult. They were writing for public persuasion, and they were wonderful at it. And we think that high school students today could read Trenchard and Gordon quite happily, maybe not as much as we have, but they can read at least one or two of the articles and get something out of it.
Well, how long ago was it, 2,000 years ago or so, Socrates said that youth is undependable, it's all, they're all rotten to the core, we should give up on the human...
Oh, but he said the unexamined life is not worth living.
Fair enough.
Precisely.
Paul, let me ask you, we'll conclude our conversation. We've been talking about both of you as participants in the Summer Institute at the Humanities Center. You are a college professor. You are sort of at the other end of the pipeline. Pat Reifschneider teaches these kids in high schools and then turns them over to you. Are you happy? Let's not put it that way. What do you think of the state of humanities education in the high schools today?
I think that except at a small cluster of elite schools, and most of those are private schools, mm-hmm. I regret to have to say, that humanities education is not working. I think there's a sense in which many of the students that I see coming into college and into a private school, not into a great state university which takes everyone, all comers, mm-hmm. are not only culturally illiterate, they're almost functionally illiterate.
They don't know how to write, for example.
They can't put a paragraph together. Mm-hmm. And in a certain sense, we have to start from scratch in educating them. Now, it's not true of all of them. But it's true of so many of them, and it's a great frustration to them because what it means is that they don't arrive finding it easy to learn. They have to work extraordinarily hard at the simple things because somehow or other, down lower, mm-hmm. they've not picked up these things. I think that there is a terrible crisis in American education.
They're working both on skills and on content at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's like learning a language. I mean, there is a certain sense in which American students coming to college have to learn English as a second language mm-hmm. because they've not really learned it in the schools. And that means that in some sense, many of our high schools are functioning as large-scale daycare centers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly where the energies are going, and I don't know exactly the source of the problem. But I can see the results at the other end of the pipeline.
What, very briefly, would you do about this? Is it a question of the government throwing money at the schools? Is it a question of parents assuming more responsibility for the education of their children? Is it a question of parents talking to teachers? We've got a lot of alternatives there.
I think that perhaps the key to it is the parents. Mm-hmm. And I think that a parent who has a student who comes home from school without homework, should rebel mm-hmm. and should raise Cain. And that a parent who discovers that their child or their children aren't learning to write so that they can put paragraphs together that are coherent and yeah. a pleasure to read yeah. should rebel and
right.
raise Cain.
Right, and therefore think.
And also learning to read. Mm-hmm. There's a certain sense in which you write as you read.
Right.
And if the reading is too easy, if it's not classic works, and if students are not being taught to read between the lines of the books that they're assigned, and to ask the question, why was this word chosen? Why this phrase? Why does he say this here and later say that? Mm-hmm. Then I think something's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Pat Reifsteiner, let me ask you to conclude. What wisdom or observation might you offer, well, for example, to parents about humanities education in the high schools?
Well, I'd like to second Paul's comment that it should be difficult. If it's too easy, if the kid can get through his homework too fast, I would be suspicious because you have to learn to read difficult material. My school gave me a sabbatical back in 1979, and I went to work as a paralegal at Community Legal Services in a really desperately poor part of Philadelphia. And most of the people I worked with simply had gotten in trouble because they couldn't read a difficult contract or something of that kind. And I realized that teaching the Iliad to 10th graders was worth it because they had to read something that wasn't easy, that wasn't immediate fun. It gave them great pleasure when they'd finished it. And then it gave them pleasure to go back to it. But the first time through was painful. But they, having read the Iliad, they can certainly read those contracts or whatever it is that they're asked to sign. And I think that's, you know, a function of humanities education.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation about ancient and modern republicanism, the topic of a recent summer seminar for high school teachers sponsored by the National Humanities Center. My guests were Patricia Reifsteiner of Germantown Friends School in Philadelphia and Paul Ray of the University of Tulsa. Soundings on the Humanities and Secondary Education continues now with a conversation about modern literary representations of the self, the topic of another summer seminar for high school teachers sponsored by the National Humanities Center.
Sarah Fulcher from Portland, Maine, Deering High School, and Patricia Meyer Spax from Yale University. We're going to talk about a summer institute at the National Humanities Center, Representations of the Self in Literature. Sarah, that's pretty heady stuff for high school teachers and high school kids. Am I wrong?
Well, we deal with a lot of heady issues in high school. It was exciting to me in particular because of late years, I've been more and more convinced that the way to teach literature to high school kids is to do it thematically. Mm-hmm. And here was a program that offered a number of pieces that I know and love and an almost equal number of pieces that were totally new to me, grouped in a very scintillating way. In a way that I hadn't thought about before.
Let me badger you, as an English teacher should. Be specific and be concrete. What have you been up to? Name a name, name a book, and
well,
why?
Well, I just didn't know the works of Zora Neale Hurston, and mm-hmm. I feel embarrassed that I didn't, but I had never heard of Hurston, and so reading Their Eyes Were Watching God was a whole new experience for me, and a wonderful one, and I will be teaching it next fall.
Pat Spax, why is this a noteworthy kind of thing for a high school teacher to look at?
You mean this particular book?
Right, the Hurston book.
It's a book by a black woman author, which is one of the reasons it's particularly interesting, and I have used it in my section of the Institute, which has to do with female self-representations, particularly. It's a very important novel, a great, great novel that has only recently been rediscovered, partly because it's only recently been reissued in paperback and mm-hmm. become available.
Mm-hmm. What's special here? I mean, we can say that we have the feminine voice, we have a black feminine voice, but help me with that.
Well, Hurston has a remarkable command of language. She writes very lyrical prose, and in this lyrical prose, she celebrates the coming of age and the growth and full maturity of a black lower class, working class, sort of sub-working class woman in the South, and it's very exhilarating reading. I have used it three times now and been interested in how different kinds of people respond enthusiastically to mm-hmm. it. I think one of the things that the Institute does is not only to present new texts that wouldn't be familiar in high school, such as Their Eyes Were Watching God, but also to suggest new approaches to familiar texts. Another of the books that I do is Jane Eyre. And Stephen Marcus, in his section of the seminar, deals always with Dickens. These are books that are very familiar to high school teachers, but there are new ways of thinking about them, and mm-hmm. I think that's another valuable contribution of the mm-hmm. Institute.
All right, your Institute is called Representations of the Self. Sarah Fulcher, are your kids interested in themselves? How do you teach a topic like that to high school kids? Again, kind of heady stuff. I'm baiting you a little bit.
Oh, indeed you are. The self is where we all start from. And yes, of course, they're interested in themselves. And it's a standard part of our curriculum to have students write their autobiographies. So this material is particularly interesting since we're looking at biographies, autobiographies, and fiction, and looking at the ways in which people choose to tell their stories, as mm-hmm. Pat has said. And what I've gained thus far from the seminar is not only the complexity of that act of representing oneself, the changeability of it, how we change our stories as we move and grow, but also the necessity of it for us to maintain our mental health, that as we see particularly in the Hurston book, mm-hmm. Janie, the main character, grows as she learns to tell her story in different ways. And as she takes on the act of storytelling and participates more fully in her community, not allowing the men to be the only ones who mm-hmm. tell the stories on that porch mm-hmm. in the center of town.
Pat Spax.
I think one of the interesting things about the Institute is that it has three faculty members, three university teachers working in collaboration. The system we use is that each takes responsibility, primary responsibility, for roughly a week, with the other two intervening as the spirit moves them. And this serves the purpose of demonstrating for all of us how many different stories we all tell, even about the books we read, because there are differences of opinion among the three faculty members as well as among the participants in the institute, and the method itself demonstrates the diversity of approach possible and the drama of that diversity.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds like you're all having a wonderful time in this summer institute. Sarah, let me throw down a bit of a gauntlet here. I hear stories about high school teachers who are burned out. They are sick of teaching. They don't have much self-esteem. They have a real rough time with it. This morning, I did an interview with a couple of your colleagues that appears on the same edition of Soundings. One of them described high school teaching and education in this country in a state of crisis. Now, those are pretty tough words, and yet here you are sort of all aglow in the great fun of doing literature with three college professors. We got a polarity there. Help me to understand it.
Well, one way to understand it is that I'm here right now, and I'm with Professor Spax and with Stephen Marcus and James Olney, and that's bound to be very exciting. But as I think back to my situation at home, and as I think about the situation that I've heard from my colleagues, I find it deeply disturbing to discover that we are still under attack from the same sources that we've been under attack from for a long time. For example, I find that some of the colleagues in this seminar are teaching English to 150 students. That's their load.
Goodness.
And how can they possibly set up a classroom which invites participation from students? How can the students have the chance to do what I'm doing in this seminar when there are as many as 37 of them mm-hmm. sitting in a classroom?
Is this a hopeless situation?
I think this is where I differ with Bill Bennett. I think it's nothing that some money couldn't fix up. Uh-huh. We need just about twice as many teachers, and twice as many classrooms, and twice as many books. And I think those are things you can purchase.
Oh, I think Bill would agree with you about that. He just doesn't want to spend the money that the government has there. We'll send him a copy of this program. Pat, tell me about what you have come to understand with respect to the teaching of humanities in the high schools, given your experience with these teachers in this summer institute.
It seems to me that one of the issues coming right out of what Sarah just said is what it is that you want to teach when you're teaching literature in high school. One of the books we've been discussing this summer is Dickens's Hard Times, which is, as Stephen Marcus says, a book about education, and it starts with the proposition that education consists in giving people hard facts. Most teachers of English, certainly virtually all university teachers of English and all the high school teachers of English I know, would agree that the function of teaching literature is not to teach facts, but to teach ways of thinking. And if ways of thinking are what you're trying to teach, you simply can't do it with large numbers of people. It seems very discouraging to think of the fact that in these summer institutes, we spend our time trying to talk about approaches, about ways of using material, about ways of thinking, and that some of the people who are here have so little opportunity, really, to put it into practice. Mm-hmm. Although my feeling after doing this now for three summers is that high school teachers, in fact, do miraculous things with virtually no resources at all,
mm-hmm.
which is not to say they wouldn't be a lot better off with more resources, I hasten to add.
Fair enough. Is this because the kids are dumber? Is it because the teachers aren't teaching the right stuff? Is it because there's too much fighting about what to teach them? We got some knots there. I'm sure I'm leaving out an alternative.
None of the above. None of the above.
What is the problem?
I think it's because the cultural situation has simply become so much more complicated that we are now conscious of many more books, many more authors, many more cultures that form part of the American cultural scene, and the effort to resolve the problem that new knowledge and awareness creates by saying, let's return to the basics, let's return to the old male, white, Western culture, doesn't really resolve the difficulties that have been created by our new knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about that at lunch today, and talking about our fears that there is this kind of oversimplification, that we need to return to the great books, and that that core will exclude many of the things which will most speak with the greatest immediacy to our mm-hmm. students. I was trying to teach some of my juniors this last year a little bit about prejudice, because I had chosen some books which I thought would address the issue, and I discovered that our students need to know a great deal about the origin of prejudice, because we have new waves of immigration, and that even as I was teaching Native Son to my students, I was discovering that their prejudices against Southeast Asians need to be addressed. And I'm going to be teaching Maxine Hong Kingston's book that we've studied in this seminar,
mm-hmm.
which may in some way help to address that. But I think that through literature we can reach our students, and that we do reach our students, and that if we can make them read, turn off the television for a little while, mm-hmm. no, they're no dumber than they used to be. They're just as smart as they used to be. And I think we have, through the humanities more than any other way, we have the opportunity to make differences in their lives.
Pat Spax.
It seems to me that one of the challenges of this institute from the point of view of university teachers is the challenge of reaching a different kind of audience from the audience that university teachers ordinarily deal with. Because we're dealing with high school teachers in this seminar, we are very conscious, very vividly conscious of all those high school students out there who need ways of thinking and ways of understanding. And the challenge of constantly thinking about how literary texts can be used as a way of conveying enlightenment of various sorts is extremely valuable. The enterprise in itself, in other words, is a way of thinking about and talking about the place of the humanities in educational experience.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about modern literary representations of the self, the subject of a recent summer seminar for high school teachers sponsored by the National Humanities Center. My guests were Sarah Fulshep of Deering High School in Portland, Maine, and Patricia Meyer Spax of Yale University. For a cassette copy of Soundings on the Humanities and Secondary Education, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, discussions about literary and social aspects of 19th century British culture. My guests will be Anthony Kenny of Balliol College at Oxford University and Richard Soloway of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
This week on Soundings, Republics, Ancient and Modern, and Literary Representations of the Self. Listen for college professors and high school instructors who participated in two recent summer seminars at the National Humanities Center. Republics, Ancient and Modern, and Literary Representations of the Self. This week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.